So today we're going to continue for a little bit with entanglement theory for pure bipartite states. I'll review a little bit of what we did last time. And then I'm going to say a few things about mixed state entanglement and multipartite entanglement. And then I'm going to move on to other resource theories that are inspired by entanglement theory. In particular, I'll say a lot about the resource theory of states that break symmetries. And I'll say a little bit about the resource theory of states that are out of thermal equilibrium. OK, so for the pure bipartite states, what we saw last time was that a very powerful tool is Nielsen's theorem, which says that the conditions under which some bipartite pure state psi can go to phi under LOCC is determined by the spectra of the reduced density operators, and it's just the majorization relation. And remember the majorization relation for two probability vectors, if I just order them in decreasing order, the biggest one has to be larger, the biggest value of x has to be larger than the biggest value of y, the sum of the two biggest values have to be larger than the sum of the two biggest values of y, and so on. So one thing we showed was that, you know, this implies that for two states to be equivalent under LOCC transformations, their spectra of the reduced density operators have to be exactly equal, which means they're equivalent up to local unitaries. And we talked about what that means for defining measures of entanglement for these states. So remember, measure of entanglement, just any function over the states, which is non-increasing under LOCC. And so we showed that if you use the Schur concave functions, which always respect the majorization order, you can define various entanglement measures for pure bipartite states. So here was a few of them, the entanglement entropy, the Renyi-based generalization of that. And finally, I ended by emphasizing the following fact, and I'll emphasize it again, which is that unless you're talking about just two qubits, so anything more general than two qubits, the order relation you get among the bipartite pure states. So the ordering relation here is, you know, psi can be converted to phi under LOCC. So I connect them whenever that's true. That order relation is not a total order, it's a partial order. So that means that there are going to be, so this is just a little sort of a fragment of the total order of all the bipartite pure states, but there will be instances of pairs of states, like phi and chi in this example, where you can't go from one to the other by LOCC, nor can you go the other direction by LOCC. So they're just incomparable. You can't get between them. And that means that no single measure of entanglement can capture all the information that's there in that partial order. Okay, so if you think of that partial order as really being the, really telling you the most information about the structure of the entangled states, right, because it tells you exactly what can be converted to what under LOCC, no single measure of entanglement can capture it, because every particular measure of entanglement either will assign the same value to these guys, or it'll assign a larger value to phi than to chi, or a larger value to chi than to phi. All that's consistent with the definition. But because it induces a total order, it can't capture this structure. I would need at least two measures of entanglement to find out that phi and chi are indeed incomparable. If I found two different measures of entanglement, which said one said phi has more entanglement than chi, and the other said the vice versa, I could then conclude these two states must be incomparable. And so in general, if you want to reproduce the order of states under LOCC, you need many measures of entanglement. And so an interesting question is, can you find a way of expressing the necessary and sufficient conditions for interconvertibility in terms of a set of entanglement measures being non-increasing? So this, we'll call this a complete set of entanglement measures. If satisfying all of these inequalities for some set implies that psi can go to phi by LOCC. So in the context of pure bipartite states, it turns out you can do this. So first of all, remember the definition of majorization. And remember the definition of Schur concavity, which is that g of x should be less than g of y if x majorizes y. Remember, majorization, x majorizes y if x is less mixed than y. Okay, so Schur concavity basically measure sort of how close you are to being a uniform distribution. So what you immediately see, if you just sum up the largest elements of the probability distribution, and you take the negative of that quantity, so k is any number between 1 and d minus 1, that's going to give you a sure concave function, because the sum of any set is always going to be larger than the corresponding sum for the y's, and so to get the inequality to go this way, I just need to take a negative sign. So this is a sure concave function. It's sometimes called the Kaifan K-norm. And therefore, if I define an entanglement measure just in terms of the spectra of the reduced density operator of psi, what we saw last time is from every sure concave function, I get an entanglement measure. So these guys are now entanglement measures, and there's going to be d minus one of them. It's convenient, and then the point is that it's a complete set, because once I've got all of these inequalities, that just implies all these inequalities. So it's just another way of expressing the majorization relation, but now it's in terms of these entanglement measures. And then it's nice just to rewrite this. If I just add the constant 1 to this measure, then because the sum of all these eigenvalues is just 1, this is the sum of all the eigenvalues, I'm subtracting off the leading k largest ones. And so I'm left with the k plus 1 to d sum, the smallest one. So the various sums of the smallest elements of the distribution give entanglement measures. Okay, so that's a nice way of expressing the conditions for LOCC conversion. You just can check all of these inequalities for this particular entanglement measure, and you're done. You know whether it converts. Yes? Yes? Mm-hmm. It should be more peaked than the distribution for y. That's right. So like for example, yeah, so the trick is that it has to do with the fact that if you were just concerned with the order under majorization, then at the top of the order you have the things that are like 1, 0, 0, 0, they're very non-uniform distributions. At the bottom of the order you have the uniform distributions. But over on the entanglement side it goes the opposite way. So the very uniform distributions correspond to reduced density operators that are close to mixed. That means a high degree of entanglement. So they're at the top of the order, and at the bottom of the order are the very non-uniform distributions. And so when we ask which kinds of functions over the majorization order turn into entanglement measures, it's not the functions that have high values at the top of the order and low values at the bottom of the order. It's the functions that have high values at the bottom of the order and low values at the top of the order. And that's why you choose it to be sure concave rather than sure convex. So the inequality goes this way. Does that clarify it? Good. Other questions? Okay. So. I'm going to move on to a different notion of, I'm going to say something about the relevance of these measures now. So I'm going to ask now about stochastic state conversion. So there the idea is, can you turn psi into phi with some probability, some non-zero probability? So previously we were interested in the question of whether I could do it deterministically. Now we just want to say, well, it could be that it's, you do a measurement during your LOCC protocol and it's only for certain outcomes that you actually succeed at getting phi, and you're interested in making that probability as large as possible. So what are the necessary and sufficient conditions for this sort of conversion? So it's possible to show that in terms of these measures that we just saw, that probability is given by the minimum ratio of that measure of entanglement for psi and for phi. Remember, there were d minus one of them, so you just take the smallest such ratio where k varies from, one to d minus one, and that will give you the probability. So this is known as Vidal's theorem, and it's not too difficult to prove. The idea is that you can show that these entanglement measures are convex in the sense that if psi gets transformed to an ensemble of states, so I've done some measurement with some probability it gets mapped to phi I with probability pi. So it turns out that the average of one of these entanglement measures in that ensemble is always less than the original entanglement measure. And that means that for any particular element of the ensemble, like probability p times phi, p times that entanglement measure on phi is going to be less than the original entanglement measure. So ek phi p is going to be less than ek of psi. And that's going to be true for all the k. So we know that p is going to be less than the minimum over k of these ratios. And then the only thing you need to prove is that, in fact, you can always saturate this inequality. There's a protocol that allows you to do the conversion with a probability p given by that minimum. A nice thing about this result is that you can immediately recover the majorization result we saw previously. So if I demand that p be 1, it says that all of these ratios, the minimum of all these ratios, has to be greater than or equal to 1. So that means for every k, ek psi has to be greater than ek phi. But you know, these just reproduced the majorization order. So this just tells me, again, that the spectrum of psi has to be majorized by the spectrum of phi. Another thing you can do is ask, well, when can it not be done? When can you not convert psi to phi? So when is the probability 0? And that's going to happen whenever the rank of the reduced density operator on psi is, strictly less than the rank of the reduced density operator on phi. Because whenever that occurs, there will be some value of k where all the smallest eigenvalues beyond that value are 0. But for that value of k, phi has some non-zero eigenvalues. And so then this ratio becomes 0, and you know that the probability of conversion is 0. So this tells you that you need your initial state to be of higher rank if you want to convert it, even with just some non-zero probability of success. You don't even want to do it deterministically, just some non-zero probability of success. The rank cannot go up. Yes? No, what I'm saying is that imagine all the set of all possible LOCC protocols. Some of them will be such that you don't get the outcome you want, phi. You start with psi. You don't get the outcome phi deterministically. It's just that at the end of the protocol, you've gotten one of many possible outcomes. You know, think of all the measurements that happen in the protocol as just one big measurement, which has all these different outcomes, some finite number. So it may happen that you only get phi for one of those outcomes. And the question is, what's the probability of that outcome? I'm sorry?
I'm
If the outcomes of my measurements just form a discrete set, then I don't need any measure theory, really. It's just what's the probability of the outcome of those measurements that gets me to the final state, phi. So it's really, I'm getting this P out of the Born rule. I'm just saying, oh, I did a measurement on the initial state in this protocol, and here's the probability I got the right outcome. And it's just that, you know, so like last time we talked about this simple example of converting the state phi plus to cos theta 0, 0 plus sine theta 1, 1, if you remember that example. And that involved a two-outcome measurement. One of the outcomes just gave me cos theta 0, 0 plus sine theta 1, 1 immediately. And the other one gave me something different. Now, I was able to fix that because, you know, Alice could transmit some information to Bob and they could get what they want. But I could have just asked, you know, if I wasn't able to fix that, I could have just said, well, what's the probability of getting that first outcome which gives me what I want? And that's essentially what's going on here. That's what that probability P means. That's right. It's the probability of an outcome in that protocol. And then you optimize over all protocols trying to make the probability of the outcome you're looking for as high as possible. That's the idea. Yes? That's right. So as long as the probability is less than or equal to the minimum of these fractions, then you can always achieve this transition with that probability. So in particular, you can, I'm sorry, including the equality, yeah. Okay, so one consequence of this fact is that if we ask under what conditions are two states not LOCC equivalent, so we talked last time, and I reviewed the situation where you could go from psi to phi deterministically and phi back to psi deterministically. But now we can just ask, when is it the case that I can go from psi to phi with some probability that's not zero, and also I can go back from phi to psi with some probability that's not zero? It's just going to be the equality of the ranks. So that's because, you know, over here we showed that I get zero probability whenever the rank of one is strictly less than the rank of the other. So if I want it to be non-zero in both directions, those ranks have to be equal. So these ranks of the reduced density operators are what's called the Schmidt number. So they're just the number of Schmidt coefficients in the bi-orthogonal decomposition that are non-zero. And so what this says is that if you're only interested in interconversion with non-zero probability, then you don't care about the full set of Schmidt coefficients. All you care about is how many non-zero elements there are. And as long as they're the same, you can reversibly interconvert in that sense. Okay, so you know, we've talked about deterministic conversion. I introduced this second notion of stochastic conversion, which involves a different entanglement measure, these Kaifan norms. There's another notion of conversion that's discussed in entanglement theory, and that's catalytic conversion. So you can ask the following. You can say, is it possible that although psi cannot go to phi by LOCC, perhaps if I'm allowed to borrow some entangled state eta, which I have to return at the end of the protocol, it makes it possible for psi to go to phi. So this is called catalysis because it's similar to what you'd have in chemistry, where maybe there's some reaction that doesn't go forward unless there's some catalyst present, but that catalyst doesn't get used up by the reaction, it just allows it, so it doesn't get consumed, it's just a bystander. So the question is, could there be transitions like that? And it turns out, surprisingly, there are. Entanglement theory has catalysis. You can find examples of this. And ultimately, it's because in majorization theory, it's possible to find two vectors of probability such that one doesn't majorize the other, but there is some other probability distribution such that the tensor product of Z with your initial does majorize the tensor product of Z with the final. And so this was one of the, this was the third problem in the problem set in yesterday's session. It concerned examples of catalysis. So I won't repeat the simple examples here. But this is a really interesting phenomenon in entanglement theory. And I want to mention just one other thing about it, because last time we had a question about additive measures of entanglement. If you focused, an additive measure of entanglement is one which, when you evaluate it on a tensor product of states, it's just the sum of the measures for each of the states. So the point is that if you just focused on additive measures, you would not be able to distinguish the deterministic order of states under LOCC from the catalytic order. So what do I mean by that? I mean, if you know, for example, that psi goes to phi by catalysis, and so some entanglement measure warrants that. It says, okay, well, the entanglement is not going up under this transition, so as far as this measure is concerned, it's possible that psi could go to phi by catalysis. If the measure is additive, then I just get this inequality, and I can cancel the E etas. And so according to that measure, it also has no problem with psi going to phi, right? It says that, yeah, the entanglement's not increasing for that transition either. So if I just focused on additive measures, they wouldn't be able to tell me that there exists some transitions that are possible catalytically, but are not possible without the catalyst. Because any additive measure that said that the catalytic transition was possible would also say that the ordinary transition was possible. So if you want to distinguish these two kinds of order relations among the states, catalytic conversion and deterministic conversion, you need non-additive measures of entanglement to do it. Okay. Another notion of conversion that we saw last time was this notion of asymptotic state conversion. So there, you have not a single copy of psi, but n copies of psi. And this came up in the context of distilling maximally entangled states, phi plus. But you can also ask for any other state, phi, what's the rate at which I can convert the state psi into copies of the state phi? So again, what that means is, what's the largest value I can make the ratio m over n, the number of copies of the output over the number of copies of the input, in the limit that n goes to infinity, such that some LOCC operation acting on the n copies of the input takes me arbitrarily close to m copies of the output in the sense of the one norm. So you can ask that question for any final state, not just phi plus, and what you find is that it's just given by the ratio of the values of the entanglement entropy. So that's just the von Neumann entropy of the reduced density operator. So that's obviously consistent with what we saw last time, because phi plus just has an entanglement measure one. And what it shows is that the rate of conversion in one direction is just the inverse of the rate of conversion in the opposite direction. So if I asked at what rate could I go from phi to psi, it would just be e phi over e psi. So the rate in one direction is the inverse of the rate in the other. And it means that basically in this asymptotic sense, I can go reversibly. I can convert my resource of psi into phi and back again without any loss. And I can do this for any two bipartite states. So it means that all the states among the bipartite pure states are interconvertible in this asymptotic sense. That's right, yeah, unless they're not entangled, yes. Okay. So the proof of this would take too long, but I thought it might be nice to give you a kind of flavor of the proof or you know, motivate why this is a reasonable type of answer. I'm going to use Nielsen's theorem to give you the intuition. So if we forget about the fact that this is supposed to happen just, you know, approximately, and you know, it becomes close to the final state in the limit, and just ask, well, what are the conditions under which I could do this exactly? Then Nielsen's theorem says, well, the spectrum of the reduced density operator of these m copies of phi has to majorize the spectrum of the reduced density operators for the n copies of psi. And that just means that I can, you know, what is the spectrum of a product of density operators? Well, it's just the tensor product of the spectra of those guys. So it becomes this condition. And as we saw last time, this majorization condition is equivalent to saying that there exists some doubly stochastic matrix that takes the initial probability distribution, it takes the distribution on the left of the majorization relation to the distribution on the right. And you know, we talked about how this thing is equivalent to just a mixture of permutations. So once I have it in that form, these are all if and only if, once I have it in this form, then that's a recognizable problem. It's really the question of whether some m samples of a probability distribution can be converted by some classical data processing into n samples of some other probability distribution. And that's just the kind of problem that classical Shannon theory addresses. So if my probability distributions are x and y, so you can think of this as, you know, the probability of generating one of a set of symbols in a channel, y is some other probability distribution over a set of symbols. So the question of can I convert m copies to n copies is answered by Shannon's noiseless coding theorem, which you'll probably hear about in one of your lectures. And the answer is just that the rate of conversion is given by the ratio of the Shannon entropies of those distributions. So that means that, you know, this problem over here is just the rate for this is determined by the ratio of the Shannon entropies. So the limiting value of n over m in this transition is just the entropy of this initial distribution over the entropy of the final distribution. But what I'm interested in the entanglement scenario is the ratio of m over n. Remember, there's this sort of change in the order when you go between the probability distributions and the entangled states. So the rate at which psi can be converted to phi is just the inverse of this rate. So it's the Shannon entropy of the distribution for the initial state over the Shannon entropy of the distribution for the final state. And that's just this ratio of entanglement entropies. So this is just meant to give you the flavor for, you know, why you expect these entropies to show up at all. Like, why should it be an entanglement entropy as opposed to anything else? And the answer is that there's this connection through Nielsen to classical channels and Shannon's noiseless coding theorem tells us that rates of conversion in classical channel theory are given by the Shannon entropy. Okay, so I mentioned that if we allow our final state or ask for our final state to be this phi plus maximally entangled state, then given that it has a measure entanglement one, we just get e psi over one. So the what's called the distillable entanglement, the number of copies of phi plus you can get out, is just e psi. But if you ask the question of if I want to convert copies of phi plus into copies of psi, so I have my kind of refined entanglement at the beginning, I'm trying to prepare copies of psi. That's sometimes called entanglement dilution. So psi is some less than maximally entangled state. How many copies of phi plus do I need to generate a single copy of psi? Well, this asymptotic rate tells me what the rate of conversion from phi plus to psi is. It's just one over the entanglement entropy. And therefore, if I ask how many copies of phi plus do I need to generate a single copy of psi in this asymptotic sense, it's just the inverse of that quantity. So the entanglement cost, in this case, is e psi. And so the result is that for bipartite pure states, the distillable entanglement and the entanglement cost are equal. So if you invest a certain number of maximally entangled pairs to build up your state, you can always get that number out again in this asymptotic sense. Good. All right, so that's what I wanted to say, all I wanted to say about bipartite pure entanglement. Are there questions about it from this or what we covered last time? No? All right, let's move on. So, mixed state entanglement. Here are some of the questions we've been talking about for the pure bipartite case. Deterministic state conversion, when are states equivalent under LOCC? When can I convert them with some probability? What about catalysis? What about in the asymptotic limit? How do we define measures of entanglement? You can ask all of these questions in the harder context of mixed state entanglement. And generally, we know a lot less about the answers to all these questions in the mixed state case. And I'm not going to go over all of this stuff because I'm not sure how instructive it would be. I'm just going to hit a couple of interesting facts about mixed state entanglement. So remember that the definition we gave for measures of entanglement applied just as well to mixed states. So if, you know, rho and sigma are bipartite mixed states, it's still the case that we define a measure of entanglement as some scalar function over the states which is non-increasing under LOCC. So it's nice to have definitions of measures of entanglement that work not just for the bipartite pure states, but for any state. All the ones I've shown you so far work only for the bipartite pure states. But there's a simple way of defining entanglement measures in a geometric way. So roughly speaking, you can define them in terms of the distance to the set of separable states, the unentangled states. But there's lots of different notions of distance you can use corresponding to the lots of different distinguishability measures we have for pairs of quantum states. So Patrick talked a bit about distinguishability measures in quantum information. And their key property was, so they quantify how distinguishable two states, like rho 1 and rho 2 are. And their key property is that under any completely positive trace preserving map, the amount of distinguishability goes down, right? So if I have two states that are distinguishable and I process them, well, if I've added any noise, then the distinguishability is going to go down. At best, I haven't added noise, and the distinguishability stays the same. Their distinguishability is not going to go up. So quantum data processing cannot increase distinguishability. That's, in a sense, that's the defining feature of a measure of distinguishability. OK, so if you have one of these things, then you can define an entanglement measure that works for mixed states in terms of the distance between your state rho and the nearest state in the set of separable states. So this is the infimum over all states in the separable set of your distinguishability measure. So what's the proof that this is really an entanglement measure? Let's go over it. So what we need to show is that for this measure, if I take any LOCC operation acting on rho, it's going to have a smaller or equal value to the value acting on rho alone. Okay, so let's focus on the right-hand side, first of all. So this is defined as the infimum over the separable states of the distance of rho to the separable state. So let me just call the state which achieves that minimum tau star. So this quantity is just the distance between rho and tau star. And now if I act some LOCC operation on both rho and tau star, well, I know that by the definition of a distinguishability measure, the distinguishability between those images of rho and tau star is going to be less. And then I can argue that the infimum over all separable states of the distance of the image of rho to the separable states is less than the distance of the image of rho to the image of tau star, because this state here is itself a separable state. So it's already in this set that I'm taking the minimum over. And why is it a separable state? Because if I do an LOCC operation on a separable state, it stays separable. I can't generate entanglement via LOCC operations. So this is a separable state, so I get this inequality. And so this quantity here is just the left-hand side, and we've shown through these inequalities that it's smaller than or equal to the right-hand side. So that's a valid measure of entanglement. So the popular choices of distinguishability measures for these sorts of geometric measures, the most popular one is the relative entropy, which you saw defined yesterday. The name of the entanglement measure you get by applying the relative entropy is just the relative entropy of entanglement. And that has a lot of applications. Another choice, I should say one thing, which is although it's a nice measure, it's extremely difficult to compute. So we don't have closed form expressions for the relative entropy entanglement in even the simplest examples. You can, of course, choose other measures of distinguishability. So here's one called the Bures metric. It's based on the fidelity between quantum states. It satisfies that contractivity property. This is the definition of fidelity you saw yesterday. And so I can just define a measure of entanglement as the distance in terms of this measure to the set of separable states. OK, what other kinds of measures of entanglement do we have? Well, there's lots of measures of entanglement for mixed states, and I'm not going to go over all of them, but two that are important in practical applications are the analogs of these distillable entanglement and entanglement costs that we saw in the Pure case. So it's defined in exactly the same way. The initial state now is some mixed state, rho, and I want to know for n copies of rho, how many copies of phi plus can I get out in the asymptotic limit under LOCC. And the entanglement cost is defined in a similar way. It says I start with m copies of phi plus. That's my resource. I do some LOCC operation, and I want to get a good approximation to n copies of rho, the state you're interested in. And I want to find the minimum number, in this case, of copies of phi plus that allow me to do that. So here I want to find the maximum yield of copies of phi plus, whereas here I want to use the minimum cost of copies of phi plus to do the transition. So again, this is something that is very hard to compute. We have lower bounds on these quantities for various classes of states, many of these bounds make connections between other measures of entanglement for mixed states. But rather than talk about that, I thought I would point out one interesting fact about what happens for distillation in the context of mixed states, which does not occur for pure states. And to do that, I need to tell you about the PPT criterion for entanglement. So we'll come back to this interesting fact in a moment. So, a topic I haven't covered thus far is just when can you tell whether a given state is entangled or not? So you have some mixed bipartite state. You want to know, does it admit of a decomposition into product states, a mixture of product states? So is it separable or not? That's a difficult question to answer in general. But a very powerful criterion is this one proposed by Perez. So it involves the partial transpose. So the usual transpose, of course, is just where I would take the matrix elements and transpose the matrix. But here, if this is a bipartite state, and if this these are matrix elements where the labels are for the A and the B tensor factors, then I'm just taking the transpose over the B component. So that's what this TB denotes. It's transposing only over the B component of that tensor factor. So Perez showed that if a state is separable, then it's of course positive, but also if I take its partial transpose, it stays positive. Okay, so all of its eigenvalues are still positive after the partial transpose. And that means, in particular, that if you have a state and you take its partial transpose and you find that what you get out is an operator that's not positive, then you know that your state had to have been entangled. So negative, a non-positive partial transpose implies entanglement. It's sufficient to realize that you have an entangled state. Now, there's some cases where this is an if and only if. So if you have two qubits, or a qubit and a qutrit, it's been shown that showing that your state has non-positive partial transpose is necessary and sufficient for it being entangled. So that's a very useful result. But in general, it's not an if and only if. So we also know that it doesn't go the other way in general. So there can be entangled states that are not NPT. So there exist entangled states that have positive partial transpose. Okay, so now we get to the interesting fact about distillation. So if something is an entangled state, it necessarily has non-zero entanglement cost, right? So you know, the number of copies of 5 plus I need in the asymptotic limit to make this state is going to be non-zero if that state is not separable. So these states we're talking about, these PPT states, are going to have, that are entangled, are going to have some non-zero entanglement cost. But it's also true that the PPT property is preserved by all LOCC operations. That's not very difficult to show. And so what it means is that if I'm trying to distill out phi plus, I've got n copies of rho and I'm trying to get some number of copies of phi plus, well, phi plus is one of these two qubit states, it's entangled, it has negative partial transpose. So I want to go from something that has positive partial transpose to something that has negative partial transpose, but I've only got LOCC operations to do it. And that's not possible. LOCC will always keep me in this PPT set. So I can't get any phi plus states out of this guy. So that means that the distillable entanglement for these PPT states has to be zero. So there's a gap. There's these mixed bipartite states that have a non-zero cost, but once you've spent it to form them, you can't get the entanglement out again. And so this is called bound entanglement. And there's various constructions for building states that have this property, so PPT entangled states, which are bound entangled. But I would say we don't have a good understanding of what the set of all such states looks like yet. But again, it's sort of an interesting novel feature of mixed state entanglement that you don't see in the pure bipartite case, because as we just saw a few moments ago, there the distillable entanglement is equal to the entanglement cost. Yes? Yeah, you can only have this with mixed states. In the bipartite case, this only occurs for mixed states.
Well, I don't mean this phenomenon. I understand this, but it was just a question about PPT. You apply PPT to a pure state entangled. How does it work?
It will be NPT. Yeah. I think that's right. Other questions? When you say, do we expect?
Yep.
With this, yes, that's right. Yep. Oh, do you mean like a typical state drawn at random? That's a very good question. I don't know the answer. Does anybody here know the answer to that question? Yes? Go ahead.
At least barring issues of additivity, for some entanglement measures, we know that randomly chosen mixed states can have a gap between entanglement cost and entanglement distillation, which is sort of as big as you might imagine. The entanglement cost can be almost as much as bell pairs, and the entanglement of distillation can be arbitrarily small.
And you're saying that's typical?
It's typical if you choose a random pure state.
Okay. I see.
And you choose the sizes of, you know,
Okay, so let me just repeat that. If you have a multipartite setting, like a tripartite system, then it's typical to see a gap between, and you can make an arbitrarily large gap between the entanglement cost and the distillable entanglement. So I guess it is a typical phenomenon in that sense. So I don't know offhand, but Jonathan thinks that the PPT states might be a set of measure zero in the set of all states. If so, if your question was about not about the phenomena about entanglement, but about PPT, then I guess it's not typical in that sense. Okay. So that's just a couple of topics about mixed state entanglement. Let me say a few things about multipartite entanglement. So again, we define it as that which cannot be created by local operations of classical communication. But now that we have more parties, we have to define this notion. It just means that every pair of parties have a classical channel in both directions and can do any quantum operations in their own labs. But there are no quantum channels in either direction among any of the parties. So you could, again, ask all the questions on that long list and others that I haven't talked about for the case of multipartite entanglement. And I'm just going to mention a couple of highlights. So if you ask about this notion of equivalence under stochastic LOCC, so remember, that means that we're asking whether psi can go to phi with non-zero probability and phi can go back to psi with non-zero probability. Then you find something interesting. So even for the simple case of 3 qubits, you find that if you look at the equivalence classes, they're more interesting than in the case of bipartite entanglement. So in the bipartite case, these equivalence classes were just based on the Schmidt numbers, the rank of the reduced density operators. But here we have a more fine-grained partitioning. So there's two different, so if we look at the cases of all three being sort of intrinsically three-way entangled, so there's also cases where just two of the three are entangled. But if we look at the classes where all three of them are entangled, it breaks up into two classes, one of which contains the GHZ state, and one of which contains this state here, which is called the W state. And so it means for a given state, it's either stochastic LOCC equivalent to this guy or to this guy if it is one of these true tripartite entangled states. And if you go to more parties, you find that you get more equivalence classes. So in fact, you get not even a discrete number as soon as you go to even 4 qubits. You have a parameterized family of equivalence classes. So this is all just to say that things get much more complicated when you go to the multipartite case. It becomes harder to interconvert between states. So roughly speaking, we have all these different notions of interconversion. There's deterministic, stochastic, catalytic, asymptotic. And as I move from pure bipartite pure multipartite or to mixed bipartite, it's always getting harder to interconvert between states. And therefore, the description of the solutions of the problems are typically more difficult. In the asymptotic state conversion case, you find something similar, which is that although in the bipartite pure case, you had that everything was reversibly interconvertible with everything else if it was entangled. And that's not the case anymore for multipartite entanglement. So again, you have less equivalence than you had in the bipartite case. Another interesting phenomena in the multipartite case is what's called the monogamy of entanglement, which basically means that, in some sense, entanglement can't be shared among many parties. Oops, that's not good. There we go. What's the basic result here? So if I tell you that A and B are maximally entangled, then you can conclude that A cannot be entangled at all with a third system C. So it's monogamy because it can only be maximally entangled with one other partner. And the proof is straightforward. If A and B are maximally entangled, then they have to be in a pure state. So the overall state of ABC is going to look like this. But then it has to be just a product with the state of C. So the AB composite is certainly not entangled with C. And then if I just take the trace over B to get the state on AC, it's still a product state, so A is still not entangled with C. And there's quantitative versions of monogamy, so you can find measures of entanglement such that you can derive trade-offs between the measure of entanglement between A and B and the measure of entanglement that exists between A and C. And I'm not really going to review any of those quantitative trade-offs, but you can read about them in the literature if you're interested. I'll mention that this monogamy property has actually turned out to be very useful for various applications of entanglement. So in the context of proving security of key distribution protocols, the fact that an entangled state cannot be shared among many parties is useful because Alice and Bob can essentially, if they can get evidence that systems that they've prepared really are highly entangled, then they can bound how much information some eavesdropper might have. Because if the eavesdropper is forced to be unentangled or very little entangled with their systems, then that limits how much information the eavesdropper can have about the key that they then generate based on that entanglement. There are other applications of entanglement theory that I'm not going to talk about. So there's a problem called communication complexity, which is you have two parties, they're trying to evaluate some they're trying to do some computation based on data that each of them have, and they want to minimize the amount of communication they need to do. So it turns out entanglement can improve bounds for the communication complexity of some problems. It's thought to perhaps play a role in quantum computational speedup, although that's not completely clear. And it also plays a role in what's called metrology. So these are tasks where you're trying to, for example, synchronize clocks or build a precise clock, so basically standards. So you're trying to maybe measure a phase shift or measure a distance or a time interval. So entanglement has been shown to lead to improvements for those sorts of tasks. But in a lot of these cases, I would say, although you might be able to show that for certain tasks, entanglement is necessary. I mean, some of these results just show that if you have entanglement, you can do something, but it doesn't even show that it's necessary. But many of these results show that, you know, entanglement is necessary for some kind of improvement. But it's not clear in many of these cases whether it's sufficient, whether, you know, every entangled state will be, you know, useful for this task. And if it's not sufficient, then I think it's appropriate to ask, well, what property of the state really is needed, is necessary and sufficient for improvements in these tasks. And that leads me into the part of the talk on other resource theories. So other resource theories provide an opportunity for maybe understanding which properties of quantum states really are relevant to particular tasks. So I'm going to leave entanglement behind and move on to other resource theories. So if there are remaining questions about entanglement, we should hear them now. Yes? Yeah, I hadn't thought of super dense coding as a kind of communication complexity, but yeah, I think that's right. Yep. And there are other examples where you're trying to evaluate the parity of bits in Alice's and Bob's labs, for example. Okay, let me move on to other resource theories. So the idea of a resource theory, I mean, you've basically seen the idea now, which is that, you know, in the 90s, people started thinking about entanglement as a resource, and the way they formalized that notion is by saying, let's figure out which operations we're going to allow for free, meaning you can do them without limit. It doesn't cost you anything. So in the context of entanglement theory, that was the LOCC operations. And then you define entanglement as that which you could not generate under the free operation. So because you can't generate it under the free operations, you have to, you know, worry about it. You spend it. It gets consumed to do certain tasks. If you want to move beyond LOCC, so for example, if you want to simulate one use of a qubit quantum channel, then you need to spend one e-bit of entanglement to do it through the teleportation protocol. And then you sort of try to understand the structure of entanglement by looking at, for example, the order of entangled states that's induced by these free operations. So we talked about the deterministic order, the stochastic order, the catalytic order. Those are all ways of understanding what the structure of the property of entanglement is. But you can do the same trick for other kinds of properties of quantum states. And so one example, which I'm going to talk about, is the resource of asymmetry. So the idea here is that we're interested in the properties of a quantum state that correspond to that state breaking some symmetry. So for example, if we talk about rotational symmetry, there are some quantum states that are just invariant under rotations. And there are others which, as I rotate them, become distinguishable from the initial state. So they're non-invariant. And so that is a rotational asymmetry property of that quantum state. And so if you want to say, well, I want to do the same thing for the asymmetry properties of quantum states as was done for the entanglement properties, you know, you might want to come up with measures of asymmetry and so on. And the resource theory paradigm tells you, well, the first thing you have to do is figure out what are the operations you're going to allow for free. And so in this case, it's natural to say, well, it's going to be the symmetric operations. It's the operations that don't themselves break the symmetry. And then relative to that set, you can ask, well, which states can I not prepare? Those are the ones that break the symmetry. And what order is induced over all those states by the symmetric operations? You can do it as well for the property of being out of thermal equilibrium at some temperature. So I'm just going to call that property athermality, not being thermal. And it's similar. You define a set of operations which characterize being in thermal equilibrium. And then anything which cannot be generated by those thermal operations is considered athermal. And you can look at the structure of all the athermal states that's induced by those thermal operations to understand which states are more athermal than which others. Those are two examples. I would say they're sort of prominent resource theories, but there's many other examples. So you can look at coherence between some set of subspaces, as in this resource theory paradigm, non-Gaussianity of quantum states, incompatibility of quantum measurements. There are resource theories of knowledge and steering and all sorts of interesting quantum properties, non-locality. I would say many of those resource theories are not yet well developed. But I'm gonna spend a fair bit of time on this one just so that you kind of get a flavor for what something that isn't entanglement theory looks like and what the similarities are. One final note is that I think it's important when you're defining a resource theory to keep it physical rather than mathematical. So when you say what should guide us to finding the right set of free operations, I think it's useful to ask the question, is this set of free operations something that reasonably emerges as the result of some physical constraint in the lab? LOCC emerged as a reasonable restriction. If quantum channels are expensive to build and hard to build, but classical channels are easy, then LOCC becomes a natural restriction. And I'm going to tell you about how symmetric operations are a natural restriction. But there can also be sets of operations which are only mathematically defined. And so you might say, well, I'm going to presume this is the set of free operations. But if there's no real justification for, you know, when that would be the applicable set that limited what you could do, it's not clear whether the resource theory you get out has any real physical significance. So the resource theory of asymmetry. So the early days of this resource theory concerned problems of reference frames. So people were interested in situations where you had, you know, in this case, we're going to talk about rotational symmetry. So you have two parties that are separated, and they don't share a Cartesian reference frame. So they don't agree on, you know, what's up. And then they have a problem. So for example, if Alice sends Bob a qubit as an attempt, you know, say it's a spin a half particle, and she's trying to communicate zeros and ones to him, and she says, well, I'm going to encode zero in z up and one in z down. Well, Bob can't really read that out because he doesn't know what z up and z down are, because he doesn't have a sample of Alice's frame. Or if Alice says to Bob, I'm sending you a qubit, I'd like you to rotate it by 15 degrees about what I consider to be the z axis, Bob can't do it because he doesn't have a copy of her z axis. But if Alice sends him a token of her reference frame first, so maybe she sends him some finite number of spin a half systems prepared in some quantum state and says, you know, this is going to inform you about what the orientation of my axes are, then he can use that to do some of these tasks. So he could measure spins that she later sends to him relative to that token and get some information about the bits she's trying to send. He could use that token to try to rotate around the z-axis. And so this, you can think of this thing that Al sends as a kind of quantum version of a reference frame. And you can think of this protocol as a bit like teleportation. So Bob is unable to rotate by some angle about Alice's z-axis. That's like being, you know, unable to use a quantum channel. But if he gets this quantum state, which represents Alice's reference frame, then he can simulate such a rotation. So he can go from not being able to do any operations relative to Alice's frame to being able to simulate some operations relative to Alice's frame. And he tends to consume the resource in doing so. So this token that Alice sent him gets used up as Bob uses it to do rotations and measurements on other qubits. Yes? That's true. He can, one thing he can do is try to, you know, measure, estimate what orientation it's in and get some information about how their two frames are oriented, and then, you know, proceed from there. But typically, by doing so, he takes a hit. So if he just used the quantum reference frame directly to measure, say, you know, whether Alice's spins are coming Z up or Z down, he has a higher probability of guessing correctly than if he first converts it to a classical information and then does the same thing. So there's a trade-off. So it's, for many tasks, it's better to keep your reference frame quantum. but you're right, that's one thing he certainly can do. And in that sense, it's not like the quantum teleportation protocol. Okay, so the important property about the quantum state of that token that Alice sends is that it has to break rotational symmetry. If she sent him something that, you know, was rotationally symmetric, it would be useless. So the key property of these quantum reference frames is their asymmetry. So there was a lot of work done in early days about, you know, what are the optimal quantum states for Alice to prepare to send information about orientation in space, for example, or some other group? What are the optimal measurements for Bob to do to learn that information? And you can study this for lots of different symmetry groups. So this is, you know, for rotations, but if we're interested in timing information, because say we want to synchronize distant clocks, then you need systems that are non-invariant under time translation, and so you can talk about their asymmetry properties relative to time translation. That basically corresponds to how good of a clock they are. You could talk about states that allow you to describe positions in space. So this could be useful for sort of a quantum version of GPS, so which states are best for determining relative positions of things. And really, it's just, you know, whatever symmetry you're interested in, you can ask these sorts of questions. So you get different resource theories for different notions of symmetries. Okay, so as I said, the rather than just looking at, you know, the particular task of teleportation or the particular task of, you know, aligning distant reference frames, it's useful to have a sort of more abstract approach where you say, well, what, let's try to understand something about the properties that are relevant for this task. So in this case, we want to understand the asymmetry properties. So we need to define a notion of symmetric operations that'll induce some ordering relation over the asymmetric states. So this is the definition of the symmetric operations. So first of all, you have to tell me, you know, what group you're interested in. So it could be rotations, it could be time translations, you know, phase shifts, whatever it is. And you need to specify for every system a unitary representation of that group. So if it's rotations, then, you know, a spin a half system has a particular unitary representation of rotations. An integer spin system will have a different unitary representation. You specify all that in the definition of the problem. And then the definition of a symmetric operation is this, that it's, first of all, it's a quantum operation, so it's a CP-TP map. And it just commutes with the action of the group for all the group elements. That's it. So it basically says that if I have an operation and I do any element of the group after it, or if I do it before, I get the same result. And so, you know, an example would be this. If you think about the depolarizing operation for a qubit, so it's the map that takes you from the surface of the block sphere and contracts you to a smaller sphere, well, intuitively, that's a symmetric operation. And sure enough, if you evaluate this criterion, if you imagine, you know, what happens if I depolarize and then rotate, or if I rotate and depolarize, I get exactly the same thing for all rotations. So this symmetric depolarization is indeed a symmetric operation by this definition. Okay, and it turns out that there's a way, for any symmetric operation you write down, there's always a way of implementing it as follows. It's through a Steinspring dilation. So the idea is that if this is my system here, I can bring up another system, an ancilla, which has been prepared in some symmetric state, interact it with the system of interest via some symmetric unitary, and then trace out the ancilla. So if E is a symmetric operation, it's always possible to implement it with a symmetric unitary acting on an ancilla that starts in a symmetric state. And so this is what that looks like mathematically. So as long as rho A is a symmetric state and this VSA is a symmetric unitary, I guess I didn't say it explicitly, but a symmetric state is obviously one that is invariant under the group action. You can think of it as a trivial map that has a trivial input and a non-trivial output. And so in our example of the complete depolarization, if I have a single spin and I interact it via some rotationally invariant Heisenberg interaction with an unpolarized bath of spins, that will tend to induce this symmetric depolarization on the system, and that corresponds to this sort of extension for that map. Okay, so that's the definition of symmetric operations. So now we can get busy answering all the questions of a resource theory. So this, as I said before, this is just a subset of all the questions you can ask, which we talked about in the context of entanglement. And now you can just try to answer these questions for the resource theory of asymmetry. And so I'm not going to go through all this. I'm going to just hit a couple of points, like the criterion for deterministic state conversion and something about measures of asymmetry, just to give you a flavor for how it looks in a different context. So we want to know if rho goes to sigma by some symmetric operation, you know, what are the necessary and sufficient conditions on rho and sigma for that to be true? So and now let me be careful that I don't mean here that rho goes to sigma by the action of the group. No, rho goes to sigma by the action of some CP map which commutes with the action of the group, right? So that's the definition of a symmetric operation. It commutes with all of the symmetry transformations. So we want to know what are the constraints on state transitions that arise from the dynamics being symmetric, having a symmetry. So when you put it that way, what are the constraints on state transitions that arise from symmetry? It should remind you of a result in physics, which is Noether's theorem. It sounds like Noether's theorem should answer this question. So what's Noether's theorem? Well, it says that if we have a closed system, so in the quantum context, if we have a, and I should say I'm using Noether's theorem in the general sense of just any constraint that arises from a symmetry. If the system is a closed system dynamics, so it's unitary, then if that unitary V, which describes the dynamics, commutes with all the action of the group, and if, for example, that group action is generated by some operator L, then necessarily that unitary commutes with the generator L, and that means that all moments of that generator are conserved. And the reason, so the point is that if the symmetric unitary V can take rho to sigma, then there's also a symmetric unitary, just the inverse of V, that takes sigma back to rho. So rho and sigma are reversibly interconvertible in this closed system dynamic. And that implies that all the moments of the generators of this symmetry have to be conserved. They have to have the same values on rho and sigma. So the familiar story for, you know, different symmetries, you get different conservation laws. And so it might seem like that's it. That's what we can say about the consequences of symmetric dynamics. But there are actually two problems with this approach, or two deficiencies of Noether's theorem. And the first is that it presumed from the beginning that this was a closed system dynamics. So it didn't allow that the system was coupling to some ancilla or some environment. It really says nothing at all about open system dynamics or CP maps. But as we just saw, it's perfectly reasonable to define a notion of when an open system dynamics is symmetric. You know, that's what we just did. And so we wanted to know what's the consequences of that symmetry, even if the dynamics is open. So that's something that Noether's theorem doesn't answer. And then another deficiency is that even if you look at closed system dynamics, this theorem doesn't capture all of the consequences of the symmetry. So let me explain that second point through an example. So here's a pair of states, rho and sigma, where the first system is just a spin a half, and the second system is a two-level system that's rotationally invariant. Okay? And these are just classical correlations between the spin and that other system. So if you ask, is this transition forbidden by virtue of symmetry, the answer is yes, because, for example, that initial state, you know, these are pointing up along and down along z, so it is non-invariant under rotations about the x-axis. So if I rotate about the x-axis, this state changes. But this final state is invariant about rotations about the x-axis. And similarly, the first state is symmetric under rotations about the z-axis, and the second state is not. So I can't convert these in either direction because I would be generating asymmetry. Like if I went from here to here, I would go from something that was symmetric about rotations, symmetric under rotations about z, to one that was not. And so that would be generating asymmetry from nothing. So it is forbidden by virtue of symmetry. But Noether's theorem doesn't tell you that, because if I look at the expectation values of the generator of rotations, well, it only depends on the reduced density operator for the first system. The first system is the only one that has a non-trivial representation of rotations. So I just look at the expectation value of the angular momentum operator on the first system. But this guy has reduction identity over 2, and this guy has reduction identity over 2. So they're completely rotationally symmetric, both of them, on the reduction. And therefore, the expectation values for all moments of these operators will be exactly the same. So Noether's theorem can't tell you that this transition is prohibited by virtue of symmetry. So we're going to see in a moment how measures of asymmetry can show you that that's prohibited. So how do we define measures of asymmetry? We want to fix Noether's theorem to be able to talk about these open system dynamics and really determine, even for closed system dynamics, when transitions are forbidden by virtue of symmetry. So a natural trick to use, you know, thinking about entanglement theory, is to just try to define some measures of asymmetry. And the natural definition for those is going to be any function over the states such that if rho can go to sigma by a symmetric operation, then that function is not increasing. So it has to have a larger value on rho than it has on sigma. So it's just, in all resource theories, a measure of the resource is something that is non-increasing under the operations that are considered free in that resource theory. Okay, what can we do with this? Well, first of all, notice that if it's a closed system dynamics, so if it's a reversible dynamics, then rho goes to sigma by symmetric operations, sigma goes to rho by symmetric operations. That means this inequality goes both ways, which means that your asymmetry measure is conserved. And so every asymmetry measure immediately gives you a conservation law if you're talking about closed system dynamics. If you're talking about open system dynamics, then it just gives you what you might call a monotonicity constraint. So this is like the second law of thermodynamics. It just tells you, here's something that will not increase under these transitions. So you might ask, first question you might ask is, are the Noether conserved quantities non-trivial examples, or examples of non-trivial measures of asymmetry? So what do people think? Who thinks that they are examples of asymmetry measures? Who thinks they're not? Good. They're not. And so it's not hard to see. Here's an example that shows it. So suppose you have two states, rho and sigma. So the group I'm going to be considering has a generator L. And these little L's are going to be the eigenstates of that operator. So the first state, rho, is just a mixture of these eigenstates. So if you ask about its symmetry properties, well, under any such unitary transformation, rho is completely invariant. So that means it's symmetric under the group. It has no asymmetry at all. sigma is going to be a coherent superposition of these eigenstates of L. And so under this unitary, you're going to get some change in the relative phases between those terms. So sigma is actually going to change under these transformations. So it's asymmetric under the group. Okay, so it's clear that rho cannot go to sigma. So I'm just here rewriting sigma as a density operator. So the key thing is that it has off-diagonal terms in this L basis, whereas rho does not. That signals the fact that it has some asymmetry. But if I look at the expectation value of any moment of L, it only cares about the diagonal components of these density operators. So it doesn't see the difference between these two states, and so it can't tell me that this one's asymmetric and this one's symmetric. And in fact, you can show that any function of these Noether quantities does not serve to define a non-trivial measure of asymmetry. Okay, so how can you find measures of asymmetry? And it turns out that information theory is a useful trick for defining these things. So the way you can define them is by using a very simple lemma, which makes a bridge between the problem that we're interested in, which is a problem of constrained dynamics, to a problem of information theory. So the problem we started with was, can rho go to sigma by symmetric operations? And here's a cartoon version of this. You have a state rho. You want to apply some symmetric operation to it to get sigma. And the problem that it's equivalent to over here is whether you can go from some ensemble of states. So you can consider rho and every possible rotation of rho in the group, right? So the whole orbit under the group action of rho. And you want to know whether it goes to the corresponding element of the orbit of sigma, but now under any operation at all. So here you're transforming for every element of the group. You want to transform this transformed version of rho into the corresponding version of sigma under any operation. And just so the claim is that these are equivalent in the sense that, you know, this transformation is possible if and only if this transformation is possible. And just to see that this is not implausible, first note that this is an easier problem. You're just taking one state to another state. Here you have to take a whole set of states, each one, to a corresponding element of another set. So that's a harder transition problem because you have many more constraints. But here it's harder because you're constraining the kinds of dynamics you're allowed to make that transition, whereas here you have full control. So those things balance out. Okay, so if you look at the definition of what a symmetric operation is, then it's very trivial to prove that this is true mathematically. But I think it's more useful to get a physical intuition for why it's true. And so that's what I want to explain to you. Basically, the intuition is that these two problems I've described are actually the descriptions that two different observers would give of the same problem. So two observers that have different reference frames. So imagine Alice and Bob again. They have some Cartesian frames, and they don't know what the orientation between their Cartesian frames is. And imagine Alice prepares a state rho relative to her frame, and she's going to send it over to Bob. Bob's supposed to do an operation on it, send it back to Alice, and Alice wants to have it be the state sigma relative to her frame at the end of the protocol. So that's the challenge. Can Bob do something on it which turns it into the state sigma? So when Alice thinks about the problem, and she asks herself, well, what kinds of transformations could Bob do on this state? Well, she knows he can do anything relative to his frame. But relative to her, when she redescribes that operation relative to her frame, it's the rotated version of what Bob's done. But now she has to average over all rotations, because she doesn't know what the relative orientation of their frames are. So when she does that averaging to compute, you know, what she should expect for the final state, she effectively, that averaging ensures that her description of Bob's operations always correspond to symmetric operations. So in her perspective, the question is, can rho go to sigma by a symmetric operation? So that was the problem that we talked about on the left-hand side. But now if you think of the same problem from Bob's perspective, he thinks, okay, Alice has prepared some state rho relative to her frame. Now, how would I describe it relative to mine? Well, it's some rotation of rho, you know, whatever the rotation that relates our frames are. So from Bob's perspective, Alice is sending him one of a set of states, which is a rotated version of rho relative to his frame, but for some unknown rotation. And he's supposed to turn it into the correspondingly rotated version of sigma. That's what Alice wants to see. She wants to see the sigma state relative to her frame, which means that Bob had better prepare the sigma state that's rotated in the same way as the rho state. So he sees the task as converting an element of an ensemble of possibilities to the corresponding element of he sees it as converting an element of the orbit of rho to the corresponding element of the orbit of sigma. But when you ask, well, what are the available operations, these operations are done relative to his frame, so there's no constraint on them, so he can do anything. So from his perspective, it's this problem, okay? So that establishes the equivalence. All right, so I claim that using this, you can easily define measures of asymmetry, and the idea is that this conversion has turned our problem into a problem of information theory. Why is that? You can think of this orbit of rho, this set of states, as a quantum encoding of classical information. So the classical information is just the element of the group, and I encode every element of the group in the corresponding orbit of rho. So this set of states can be just thought of as a quantum encoding of the group element. And similarly with this set of states, it's also a quantum encoding of the group element. And we're asking, is there any transformation that takes me from here to here? And so this is the standard problem in quantum Shannon theory. I have a set of quantum states that represent some classical information, some other set of quantum states that encode classical information. Can I transform the first set to the second set by any operation at all, by any quantum data processing? So this is just a standard problem in quantum information theory. So if we can solve this problem using tools of quantum information theory, then it immediately gives us a solution to that problem. So you can, in particular, you can, if you can find any measure of the information that this set of states encodes about the group G, and quantum information theorists have defined many such measures of the information encoded in a set of quantum states about some classical message. So every such measure of information immediately gives you a measure of the asymmetry of the state rho. So this equivalence tells us that what it means for rho to be asymmetric is that it is able to carry information about the group. And what it means for rho to be more asymmetric than sigma is that rho can carry more information about the group than sigma can. And so if you give me a measure of how much information about the group rho and sigma can carry, then you also have a measure of how asymmetric rho and how asymmetric sigma are. And you can think of it like this. So what is a measure of information encoded in a set of quantum states? It's really a measure of distinguishability. So for example, here, if I have just, this is a classical example, if I'm trying to encode a direction in space and I'm using, and I'm going to sample from a probability distribution that is centered on that direction. So if I want to send z, I sample from this distribution. If I want to send an axis that's off from z, I sample from this other distribution. Now I send that to my friend, and they just get the sample, and they try to figure out what direction I'm sending. Well, if these distributions don't overlap much, then they have a good chance of estimating the direction I'm trying to send. If these distributions overlap more, then they get less information about the direction I'm trying to send. Right, so that so a channel that took me from these peaked distributions to these less peaked distributions would degrade the information about the group that's encoded here. Or if you can think of these as two different kinds of states, and therefore, you know, these classical states themselves should be thought of as, you know, this one is more asymmetric than this one because it's better able to carry information about the group. So questions about that? Are so good. Okay, so let's turn the crank and use, you know, we've seen lots of measures of information, so let's find some measures of asymmetry. So here's one that I don't think has come up yet. Patrick, did you?
No.
You didn't talk about it? Okay, so this will come up in a future lecture, but the Halevo quantity provides an upper bound on channel capacities. And it basically says if I'm encoding classical information in an ensemble of quantum states, so there's some set of quantum states, rho I, and some probability distribution over I, if that's my quantum encoding, then the Halévy quantity is just the entropy of the average of those states minus the average of the entropies of each state. So it turns out that's very useful in the context of quantum Shannon theory. This S, of course, is the von Neumann entropy. So that is a measure of the sort that we're talking about here. We can just apply it now where the classical information happens to be a group. So in that case, my ensemble of states is just this orbit of the state under the group I'm interested in, and I can use any probability measure over that orbit that I like. So the Halévy quantity is now the von Neumann entropy of the average over that group for whatever measure you're interested in, minus the average of the von Neumann entropy for each element of the group. But of course, the entropy of some unitarily rotated state is the same as the state itself. So this thing is just going to reduce to S of rho. And this, which is sort of this weighted average of the group, is called the twirling operation acting on rho. And so I'm just going to write it out as a script G sub P. And so this quantity here gives me a measure of asymmetry. It's a measure of how much information rho can, how well rho encodes information about the group. And if you think about it, it's very intuitive. Because if you say, suppose rho is symmetric under the group action, then it's going to be invariant under this twirling operation. So I'm just going to get S of rho minus S of rho. It's going to be 0. It's going to say it's not symmetric. It's not asymmetric at all. But if rho is a highly asymmetric state, then this twirling operation tends to make it much more mixed. It averages a number of different states. And so this entropy difference is large, and that tells me it's a very asymmetric state. And it turns out that this can provide play a similar role to the usual Halévy quantity in providing an upper bound on the accessible information that you have about the group element G if you're doing a communication task. So let's come back to that example I showed you of the closed system dynamics and the deficiency of the Noether conserved quantities. So, you know, we had these two states, which I knew that transition was forbidden by virtue of symmetry, but the Noether quantities didn't show it. So if I consider this Halévy quantity now, and I choose my measure to be the uniform measure over all rotations about the z-axis, okay? So that what we had on this previous slide was really a family of measures, one for every possible distribution over the group. So I'll use the particular element which has this distribution over the group. And so if I evaluate it on the initial state, well, each of these guys is invariant under rotations about z. So the entropy of the twirled version is exactly the same as the entropy of the original guy, so it's 0. But if I evaluate on this guy, well, each of these states is non-invariant under rotations about z. And so they turn into the completely mixed state. So this twirled version has entropy 2, whereas the original state had entropy 1. So I know that this Halévy asymmetry quantity is 0 for this state, 1 for this state, so I know that the transition rho to sigma is not possible because it leads to an increase in this measure of asymmetry. So I can rule out this possibility. Okay, what other measures can you come up with? Well, it's the same story that we saw in entanglement theory. You can do something entirely similar. You can use things like the trace distance to, for example, measure the distance between rho and some other element in the orbit of rho. Okay, so the distinguishability between two elements in the orbit of rho provides a measure of how much information is communicated about the group. And in particular, if I look at a particular generator of the group and I consider the case of theta being very small, I can show that the trace distance between rho and a slightly rotated version of rho is, to leading order, just the one norm of the commutator between rho and L. So this is another measure of asymmetry. And again, it's very intuitive. We saw earlier that if rho was diagonal in the eigenbasis of L, then it's symmetric. But if it doesn't commute, if it has some off-diagonal elements, then it doesn't commute with L. So you'd expect some norm of the commutator to be a measure of asymmetry. And sure enough, the one norm is proven to be such a measure. let me skip that. So you can do it with the relative Regnier entropy as well, and do the same trick of looking very close to identity. And you derive this, that this quantity is also a measure of asymmetry. So this is called the Wigner-Yanassi-Dyson skew information. So it was introduced many years ago, but it was only recently that it was recognized to actually be a measure of asymmetry. It's really a one-parameter family of such measures. And if rho is pure, it just reduces to the variance over L. So that's good, because for pure states, you expect the variance over L to quantify how much asymmetry the state has. But if rho commutes with L, then I can just move it through here and it goes to zero. And the beauty is that in between, it tells me something about how much spread over L is actually coherent. So the problem we had earlier with another quantity was that they were unable to distinguish coherent spread over L from incoherent spread over L. If I just have an incoherent mixture, there's no asymmetry. It's really the coherence that tells me there's asymmetry. And so this sort of quantity allows you to pick out that coherent spread. Okay. So you can also do these geometric measures, just like we saw in entanglement theory. You can say, how far is the given state to the set of symmetric states? Just like we asked previously, how far is a state from the separable states? So choose your favorite distinguishability measure, find the infimum over the symmetric states of that measure. You can use the relative entropy as an example. So that gives you the relative entropy of asymmetry. And in this case, it turns out that this does is simple to compute, and it just essentially boils down to that Halevo quantity I showed you for the uniform measure. So it's a very similar story for deriving measures of asymmetry as it was for deriving measures of entanglement. And again, we have a partial order. And so just like we had in entanglement theory, don't expect a single measure of asymmetry to be able to tell you exactly what the structure of states are under symmetric operations. So can you find a full set of necessary and sufficient conditions for transformation? Well, if we knew what the necessary and sufficient conditions were for converting these different orbits to one another by any operations, then we could turn that into a solution. But we don't have a solution to this problem in general. So we just have limited solutions, like we can do it for the case of pure states. There, the solution looks like this. So it's similar again to entanglement theory, that for pure states, things are a lot easier. And we have some strong results. OK, what kinds of applications are there? I think I'm running out of time. So maybe I will just say briefly some of these things and then wrap up. So if I look at quantum amplifiers and I tell you that an amplifier has a symmetry property, using something like the Halevo asymmetry can give me a bound on how much entropy must be generated by that amplifier, based only on knowing that it's a symmetric amplifier. Metrology, so if for example, I'm trying to estimate a phase shift, and so, for example, there might be a weak magnetic field here, and I'm sending a spin in, and it's gonna be rotated, and I wanna know how much is it rotated. The property of the quantum state that I send in that's critical is how distinguishable is the state under rotations. But that's precisely what a measure of rotational asymmetry is. It tells me something about how much information about rotations can be encoded in that state. So you'd expect that the figure of merit in any metrology scheme ought to be a measure of asymmetry. And that's right. If you look at a popular figure of merit, which is the variance in an unbiased estimator of phase shift, you find that it's upper bounded by 1 over this quantity, which is exactly that skew information I showed you for the case s is equal to a half. And so I said earlier that there's a lot of results in the literature about how entanglement is useful for metrology. Well, it turns out that if you have n spin halves and you say, what are the states that have a lot of asymmetry? It just so happens that those states are highly entangled. There's other highly entangled states of n spins that have no asymmetry, like a singlet of 2 spins has no asymmetry. So I think this perspective says it wasn't the entanglement that was really important. It was just that having high degrees of asymmetry necessitated having entanglement. And so entanglement was a necessary condition, but it wasn't a sufficient condition for getting good performance here. It's the amount of asymmetry that's really the sufficient condition. If you want a given amount of performance, you need to throw in a given amount of asymmetry. So this is a kind of just a useful example of how it could be that entanglement is not actually the key resource, even though it might be shown to be necessary for some task. All right, one final example. So there's these famous results about quantum speed limits. So they're telling me how much time it takes for a state rho to to evolve to a state that's orthogonal to rho. And it's a kind of energy-time uncertainty relation. So you can show that the time it takes is lower bounded by 1 over the variance in the energy for that state. And it also has a lower bound in terms of the difference between the mean of the energy and the minimum eigenvalue of the Hamiltonian that has some support on rho. And these are very useful, but they're also very bad bounds, because if I take a mixed state and I just say it's diagonal in the energy basis, then I know that it's never going to evolve to something orthogonal because it's just stationary. And so I have a really weak bound on the right-hand side because that variance is just going to be whatever it is. But I know that this thing should be infinity, so I should be able to derive better bounds. And so, in fact, if you use measures of asymmetry, you can do that. So you just redefine the left-hand side to not be the time it takes to become orthogonal, but just what's the minimum time it takes for a state, rho zero, to evolve to some state, rho of t, that's just epsilon distinguishable from rho of zero relative to your favorite measure of distinguishability. So here I've just formalized that definition. So that's the new speed of evolution. And then you can show that that kind of speed relative to, say, this L1 norm measure of distinguishability or the Renyi notion of distinguishability is lower bounded by measures of time translation asymmetry. So the generator of time translation is the Hamiltonian. This is just that L1 norm guy. That's just the skew information measure of asymmetry. So now you can get much stronger bounds that work even for mixed states. There's also, I think, some tantalizing evidence that these asymmetry measures might serve as useful order parameters. In particular, there's a few papers that have been written about the use of this skew information measure as an order parameter. But I think that I've made the point that it's very similar to entanglement theory, and it gives you a really good handle on the property that you're interested in, answering all these questions. There's this resource theory of states out of thermal equilibrium is going to be covered this afternoon in Jonathan Oppenheim's focus lecture. And because I am actually running low on time, I'm just going to skip over it entirely. If you want to hear about it, go to Jonathan's lecture. I'm not sure exactly what he's going to talk about, but he's definitely going to start by talking about what the free operations are, and then tell you perhaps something about measures of athermality and various notions of state conversion in this context. So I'm just going to skip over this. But it's basically the same sort of story. You can define measures of athermality in the same way you did for everything else. You can find some simple measures. So you can quantify, for example, how much work you can get out of a state in this kind of way. All right. So let me wrap up. So what's the appeal of this resource theory approach that was pioneered by entanglement theory and is now being used to study these other properties like asymmetry and athermality? So the first thing is that the constraints that you consider here are just the ones that are implied by the laws of quantum physics. So you're not asking, is it easy to do this particular LOCC or symmetric operation? Is it technologically feasible? No, you're defining a property, a set of free operations, regardless of how difficult it might be technologically to do it. And you're asking, what are the implications that quantum theory has for the interconversion of states under that set? So it's really independent of these sorts of practical issues. And you get all these nice questions that are very well posed and unambiguous. And having the kind of discipline to answer all those questions tends to leave you with a much better conceptual understanding of the property that you're studying in that resource theory. So we have a much better understanding of entanglement today after we've thought about it as a resource theory for many years than we did before the quantum information revolution. And also, once you start looking at these different types of resources, you start to see commonalities among them, and you can start to have better intuitions about one type of resource based on things that you learned about another resource. So just to end, I'm not exactly sure what it from qubit means, but I like to interpret it as the idea that perhaps information theory has relevance for modern physics. And to some extent, it's no surprise that entanglement theory uses information theory, because entanglement theory, as I said, was defined in terms of LOCC. There's this classical communication that's there. So there's no surprise that information theory would be pertinent for quantifying entanglement, given its definition. But when you look at the role that information theory plays, for example, in asymmetry theory, like that bridge lemma allowed me to leverage all sorts of facts about measures of quantum information into measures of asymmetry, I think that's more interesting for this kind of theme, that it suggests that things like athermality, asymmetry, which are tend not to be thought of in an information theoretic way, typically, can be reformulated in a way that's informed by information theory. And so perhaps that's a way in which information theory can invade physics, which looks like this. So thanks. Oh, sorry. Yeah, you can do the same trick for a classical theory as well. So for example, you could say, you could talk about classical correlations. You could say, suppose I only have, you know, local operations but no communication. Or here's a better example. Actually, there's a nice paper written early in the story of entanglement theory which showed a very nice analogy between entanglement theory, where you have this division between quantum channels and classical channels, and a totally classical theory where that distinction is a distinction between a public channel and a private channel. So the kind of high-grade thing that's like a quantum channel is having a private channel, so no eavesdroppers on it. But maybe what you've got is some private correlations, that's like the entanglement, and a public channel. And so the question is, can I leverage that public channel, which the eavesdropper gets to listen in on, together with my private correlations to simulate one use of a private channel? And the answer is yes, that's just the one-time pad. But you can develop a whole resource theory where, you know, your free operations are public communication and local operations, and your resource is private correlations. So yeah, there's lots of examples. And in fact, it's a nice way of talking about, so in asymmetry theory, you might ask, well, what's inherently quantum about asymmetry? And so you can say, well, there's a classical theory of asymmetry. The states are probability distributions over a group manifold. And to be a quantum asymmetric, you really need to have a set of states which are non-orthogonal under the action of the group. If they're all orthogonal under the action of the group, it just looks entirely classical. So yeah, good question. That's right. So let me be clear. Something I didn't state explicitly is that my counterexample I showed, so I said even for closed system dynamics, maybe that's the surprising thing, even for closed system dynamics, the conservation of the Noether quantities don't exhaust all the constraints. But my counterexample involved mixed states. And so that's but if you ask, well, what about for pure states? What if we have closed system dynamics and the conversion is between pure states? In that case, the Noether quantities are sufficient. Conservation of Noether quantities is all there is. But for mixed states, there are additional constraints, with the Halevo asymmetry being an example. That's right. Yeah.
So is the idea that resource theories, the way you select the PLL operations, is not due to technical difficulties, but more like based on laws of physics, and they would disagree with this? I mean, maybe this is the case for asymmetry, but for example, for OCC, like why should nature allow for classical communication without quantum? This is a technical constraint. Also, it's the same in resource theoretical approaches to thermodynamics, the kind of constraint.
Right.
And this is, in my opinion, part of the strength of.
Yes. I think you're right that I didn't express what I was trying to say very well. I mean, I guess what I was trying to say more was that, you know, often we approach a problem by saying, let's say I want to, you know, study thermodynamics. Well, I have a bath of spins. Here's the Hamiltonian. This is what the environment looks like. Here's how they're interacting. So it's a very specific model for that system. And then I look at thermodynamic consequences. And so these resource theories are not like that. They're not presuming particular models of the systems in the Hamiltonian. And they don't care about whether, you know, a given unitary is hard or easy. They do care in the sense that they start with a distinction between easy and hard. They say there's things that we're going to consider cheap and things that we're going to consider expensive. Like classical channels are cheap, quantum channels are expensive. And that's it. That's the only distinction we're going to make. And then what's the consequences of that? So in that sense, you're right. There is a sort of technological, as I was saying, it's good if that set of free operations is defined by real limitations on what you can do. So I can only do symmetric operations, or I can only do LSEC. But beyond that, once you've decided what your free operations are, there are no further considerations about, you know, what particular Hamiltonian do we have, which transformations are easier than others.